Okay, 16th.
Yes, sir.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Monday, March 16th. And I think we'll work a couple of bills. Do we have the motions ready?
We do.
Open the work session on House Bill 2600.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2600 had a public hearing on March the 6th. It requires the continuation of the group health insurance coverage for an employee that is on family leave through the state family, Oregon State Family Leave Act. We do have, there's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Who's the sponsor?
No. Representative Smith Warren.
Okay. Do I have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2600 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Question?
Yep.
On 2600, it says minimal fiscal impact on that, but this does cover employees of the state. Are all of those currently covered to where, is that why it's minimal fiscal?
I assume there's a minimal fiscal, that's the case, that, that it, it's basically covered under the, it's, I think, basically covered under the state plans now.
Rob seems to be, okay.
And did anybody know anything? I mean, I'm guessing.
I think I know.
You know? All right, I withdraw my guess. I open the floor to Representative Nose. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the reason why the impact to the state is minimal is because currently state employees are already covered by family medical, the Federal Medical Leave Act, which requires employers with 50 employees or greater to cover their workforce, and this bill does it for the Oregon Family Medical Leave Act, which is 25 employees or greater. So that, my guess is that's why it's minimal for the state.
Excuse me, but that's for the state, but then private employers.
Right, but we don't do
it. Yeah, well, the fiscal had to do with the...
No, that's right. Well, I just wanted to point that out.
Right.
It's for everyone, but the fiscal impact on the state's minimal because we don't have very many agencies with between 25 and 50 people.
Right.
But doesn't this bill on the commercial side cover everybody? There's not a 25.
It's not a state fiscal. Mm-hmm.
So it's not really aligning with what the state's doing.
Say that again, Representative Hayden. I'm sorry.
My understanding under this bill is that there's not the carve-out for small employers of 25 and under on the commercial, on the business side.
Call up.
Well, who should we call up? I could do this better from the dais, I think, or from, but maybe, you know, maybe you want the advocate to.
Yeah.
Call Family Forward.
Is Family Forward here? Want to talk to Kate? Do you want to?
25 and above.
You want to help us here? We're floundering at the moment. Yes,
thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Rep. Hayden. So employers of 25 or fewer are not covered by OFLA, so this bill would only apply to OFLA-covered employers that are 25 or more. And you're right, the state is a large employer and is both OFLA and FEMLA covered, so it already is subject to this.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Can you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
No.
Representative Klein?
Klein.
Excuse.
Representative Kennemer?
No.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
No.
Vice Chair Hayden?
No.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye. Maybe we need to get to
Chair
Representative Klein.
Let's stand at ease for a moment, please. Work session on House Bill 2600, and it's Representative Clem's turn to vote.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Smith Warner will carry it on the floor. Close the work session on House Bill 2600. And open a work session on 2931, and that that is a will be a motion to move it forward to committee, is it?
Yes,
we need
Mr.
to put it on it. Okay.
We need to, well, first of all, Mr. Chair, this appropriates money. This is the testing radon in the schools throughout the state. We had a public hearing on it last week. During the discussion, it was mentioned the dash ones. We have the dash ones before us now. The committee needs to take action on that. And then, yes, it does have a fiscal impact. It needs further analysis, so the committee will need to add a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Mr. Chair.
Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3/5/2015.
Representative Notes moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2931 dated 3/5/15. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Would you like me to explain what that is? Or not necessarily?
Would you like to explain what that is?
Sure. Basically, the bill called for schools to be tested over the next five-year period for radon unless they had been tested in the previous decade. In the original bill, it said, or if they had done any change to their HVAC system or their structural envelope. I think I used the word umbrella at the time by mistake. We decided to take the dash one takes out the HVAC because it was going to make it really unclear about what qualified and didn't qualify. And so we're just keeping it simple. If they've been tested in the last 10 years, they do not need to retest. And that was something that brought Oregon School Board Association along because of that.
Great. Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Amendments dash one is on House Bill 2931. Do we have a motion now?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move House Bill 2931 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Nose moves House Bill 2931 as amended with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the bill? On that motion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noe?
Yes.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill is on the way to Ways and Means, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2931 and move to some public hearings. Let's open a public hearing on 2026.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2026 permits a pharmacist to substitute an interchangeable biosimilar product for certain prescribed biological products. It directs the State Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules to define biological product and biosimilar product and interchangeable for the purposes of substituting the prescriptions. This has a January 1, 2016 operative date.
I assume we're going to hear something on the size of molecules. Is that right?
I have not seen that PowerPoint, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if we are or not.
Would you call the first panel, please?
Josh Bishop and Leanne Gosenwald.
Well, okay. Let's see how that happens.
Do we have a...
Anybody with either of those names?
Oh, wait. I am so sorry.
Wrong bill. Let's get to the right bill.
Yes. Tom Holt and Elise Brown. I am so sorry.
That's what happens when you have a rookie administrator.
That's right.
Somebody can buy this.
41 carried, I think. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Cambia Health Solutions, here in support of House Bill 2026. This bill is brought before you to, I think, in essence, clear the air around what have been termed biosimilars, or as the FDA calls them, interchangeable biologics, get treated on the ground at the pharmacy level. We currently have in law, because there was some uncertainty a couple of years ago what these things were going to look like as they got approved, some restrictions on the dispensing of interchangeable biologics, in order to dispense these, pharmacies would have to do special notices and keep special records and do some other things that are all obstacles to dispensing these. What this bill does is remove those obstacles permanently and treat them essentially the same way that a generic drug is treated, and that is at a pharmacy level, provided the FDA has deemed that the product is in fact interchangeable, that the pharmacist could take that action without having any additional reporting required. We know from long experience that any time there is an obstacle in the way of dispensing a drug, whether it's a prior authorization or a special notice or whatever it is, it tends to discourage dispensing of that drug. What's coming into the market, based on all indications, sometime this year, is this new class of the interchangeable biologics. The FDA has set up a new process where these products have to go through extreme scrutiny before they become approved, and the FDA deems whether or not they are in fact interchangeable. And we think the state should leave that kind of policy decision to the FDA and not get in the middle of it. The expectation is that the savings to consumers is going to be somewhere in the 25% to 35% range. We don't know yet because none of these are actually on the market yet. But we do think it is an appropriate time for the legislature to act and clear up the policy around these. I would expect, based on other discussion we've heard around this issue, that you may hear how important these products are. We agree they're very important products. We think they're really important to be able to get them in consumers' hands. We also believe it's very important, as exists now in the system, that when a product is dispensed, that there is a paper trail behind that in our electronic records, which we do through our PBMs. So we think that the time is right for this, and that the state should take this action so that consumers in Oregon can benefit from the savings that are to come from these and not be an outlier from much of the rest of the country, which will enjoy the benefits of these products when they come to the market. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Can they substitute a more expensive product?
Mr. Chair, I would expect that while technically they could, I doubt very much that our formularies would cover a more expensive item over a less expensive item.
So this could only be substitutions that come out of a formulary?
Mr. Chair, I think generally speaking, it's fair to assume that formulary management would govern a lot of this.
Anybody else? Well, let's wait until Elise finishes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elise Brown. I'm here on behalf of AHIP, which is the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And like our Cambia member, I'm here to say that all AHIP members in Oregon are proud to support House Bill 2026. Tom gave you a great background on what the bill does. We think it's a clean bill. We think it's a great bill for consumers. And we think it's one that's going to represent cost savings across the board in every segment in healthcare in Oregon. So for that, we ask for your support. Thank you.
Other questions, this panel?
Yes, sir. Chair Greenlee, thank you. I have one question regarding the 7-Eleven drugs that are currently under a carve-out in the event that some of these biosimilars would be equated by the FDA to some of those medications. Would it then be in effect?
Chair Greenlee and Representative Hayden, I don't know if any of those so-called 7-Eleven drugs would be biologics, so it may not apply at all. But, just as there are branded and generic versions of some of these drugs in the marketplace now, and they do get substituted in commercial plans We would expect that if the FDA deemed that, you know, had determined that, that something was interchangeable, that they could. But just as with generic drugs today, if a physician does not want a substitution to occur, the physician need only write on the indicate on the prescription a do not substitute. And that's available whether writing it out on paper or through, as most often happens now in electronic systems, there's a box to check or a drop-down menu to click on to say do not substitute.
Okay, thank you, guys. Mm-hmm. Yep, thank you. Let's call Dennis McNanny and Annie Marie Mayer, is it?
Hi. Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlich and Vice Chairman Hayden. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Anna Marie Meyer. I'm a single mom, and I was born in Laurelhurst and live in Happy Valley. The legislators who served my community are Senator Olson and Representative Kenemer, who I'm happy to see. As a member of this committee, I'm here today representing myself, Creaky Joints and Arthritis Support Organization, which is part of the Global Healthy Living Foundation, and other people in Oregon who are or will be taking biologics and biosimilars. I am here to express my firm opposition to House Bill 2026. I have taken biologics and had adverse reactions to them, as well as to other drugs, including antibiotics. On March 4th, I provided public comments before the Senate Committee on Healthcare in support of Senate Bill 147, which also deals with the substitution of interchangeable biosimilars. I support Senate Bill 147 because it contains notification requirements between pharmacists, physicians, and patients. These provisions are incredibly important to me because the physicians had not known exactly what drug I was taking, including the name of my biologics, when I had a severe allergic reaction. I could have died. Both I and the treatment team taking care of me knew every drug I was taking and considered these drugs when they were saving my life. Not only does House Bill 2026 lack critical notification requirements, further, it actually repeals existing law that requires a pharmacist to notify a patient like me if my biological is switched. So as you can see in my mind, this is not an argument reserved for corporations, their products, profits, or interests. It is an argument about people and what information we need in order to feel better, to control our chronic illness, and to stay alive when the worst happens. I want to be very clear when I say that I am not here to talk about whether biosimilars should or should not be on the market, or whether insurance companies should be able to influence what drug a patient takes. If a drug is approved by the FDA, I assume it is safe and effective. If my insurance company wants to switch a drug that the FDA says it may switch, I trust the FDA's decision and will take that drug. I am only asking that I and my doctor know what drug that is. I'm an Oregon citizen who is alive today because my doctor and I know what drugs I was taking. As patients, we don't want to give that up. And as compassionate legislators, you can't let that happen. Some have suggested that physicians can prevent substitution by marking dispense as written on the prescription. As a former nurse who has been involved at the point of care, I think this really misses the point. Dispense as written should be a clinical decision by a doctor based on personalized information about each patient. If it is used to get around simple notification of substituted drugs, neither patients nor doctors will have access to any biosimilar unless the physician specifically requires it. This means the billions of dollars biosimilars promise to save will be lost simply because a pharmacist doesn't want to notify a physician when a substitution is made. As patients, we don't want to prevent or deter substitutions. I love the expanded options and cost savings that biosimilars represent, but HB 2026 will force doctors to dispense as written and there deter substitution. Global Healthy Living Foundation and I urge the members of this committee to oppose House Bill 2026 because it does not put the patient first. In fact, it works to remove the patient from the healthcare decision-making process and restrict access to the most important biological development in the past 20 years. I commend this committee for realizing the importance of creating a pathway in Oregon for more affordable, interchangeable biosimilars to enter the state. We must be sure it is done safely and responsibly. House Bill 2026 puts patient safety in jeopardy by keeping physicians in the dark on what drug the patients are receiving. I appreciate your thoughtful consideration of my remarks. We'll be pleased to provide any further more information you may require.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank
you. Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll proceed. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, Chairman Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dennis McNanny. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Bioscience Association. Excuse me. I'm not sure what necessarily I need to add to the previous testimony. You hit on one of the key factors that was brought up in earlier testimony, which is trying to draw the equivalent between a generic and a biologic. Biologics can, in fact, have immunological reactions that differ between patients. One of the reasons we're concerned and why I'm testifying in opposition to 2026 is that it strips away some of the consensus we've built over the last couple of years around biosimilars and at least some form of notification from the pharmacy back to the physician of the precise drug that was dispensed. Instead of clarifying that, in fact, I think in some ways it stands in the way of substitution, as was brought up in earlier testimony. In other words, a doctor may, lacking some notification, put dispense as written as a poor substitute for proper notification. It may, in fact, lead to more skewing of prescriptions towards the reference drug versus a biosimilar, just to avoid the administrative hassle and, frankly, to know exactly what the patient's on. We would much prefer a notification process, which would then free the doctor to prescribe either or know that if a substitution was made, that they would, in fact, get that documented in the medical record. In addition, the language in the bill itself is unclear, probably was inadvertent, but the FDA distinguishes from interchangeable and therapeutically equivalent. So not that that necessarily would nullify some of the other shortcomings of the bill, but I believe there's logic inconsistencies and wording inconsistencies in the bill as written. So for that and the previous mentioned reasons, we are opposed to 2026. I would welcome any comments or questions for either of us, I suppose, at this point.
Are there any questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the association that you're with.
Oh, the Oregon Bioscience Association. I'm sorry.
Is that the question?
That's my question. Thank you.
Any other?
Kenny Guyer.
Yes, Representative Kenny
Thank
Guyer.
You, Mr. Chair. Would you support this bill with the notification suggestions?
There's lots of cleanup. I think you're better off just staying with the existing language of the bill. I think this takes us back. I mean, with some history, we've been at this for a couple years now, and there's been some really hard-won consensus between both reference drug manufacturers and biosimilars, which tells me, and both of them are members of my organization, both groups are members, that between the consensus that's been reached with some of the pharmaceutical providers, or excuse me, some of the pharmacy data interchange vendors like Allscripts, and the companies themselves offering both biosimilars and reference drugs, I think we're as close as we've ever been to consensus and agreement for a level playing field based off of the old bill. So I think this is a step backwards in any form.
Thank you. All right. Could you call the next panel, please?
Sure. Troy Rayburn, Kim Lowry, Barbara Hopkins.
That's our final panel.
She said she supported it.
Bill.
Right, which has notification.
It'd be different than otherwise.
I ask you to be relatively brief, if you will, and don't forget to introduce yourself.
Hi. And then, Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Barbara Hopkins. I'm a patient with rheumatoid arthritis. I have been treating with a rheumatologist, Dr. Callis, since January 2012. I started out on chemo pills and NSAIDs and drugs, and then additional drug, as you can see from here. I was given blood work to check my inflammation levels and livers. I worked my way through the non-biologic treatments. Some of the drugs did nothing to relieve the pain or inflammation. Others were toxic to my livers or my eyes. I was started on a biologic drug, Humira, after the insurance approval. All the biologics must go through a pre-approval process through my insurance. The insurance also has their own pharmacy. They mailed that drug to me once it was approved. And that, it cost about $1,500 treatment. I have great insurance and a great policy. The specialty tear drugs are delivered from Portland. Unfortunately, it had side effects and was toxic to my eyes, so I can't take that drug anymore. My next biologic was infusion chemo drug Rituxan, cost $14,000 per treatment. It's now not working for me, so I had a Rencia treatment Friday. It costs about $3,000 per treatment. All of those drugs have a biosimilar, and I will be glad that they will be approved shortly. It may give me some other treatment options. I take over 21 prescription drugs and over-the-counter. They couldn't all fit in here because some of them I buy at Costco, and they're huge. The pharmacist, the specialty pharmacy, does not know the drugs I am taking. They don't know what my allergies are. They don't know that when I start a new drug, I need to see an eye doctor to have extra lab work. And I don't want them substituting a pen for a syringe. If I have an allergic reaction or adverse side effects, I want to know what they are. So hopefully you'll amend the bill and put patient notification and doctor notification. I have a very complicated medical conditions, and I need to be notified what drugs I'm taking.
We wouldn't need to amend the bill to do that. The current law requires that. So this bill would amend the current law.
But patient needs to be notified, and currently it's written it does not.
I say the current law that's enforced does require notification. This would take that away. Next.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick and honorable members of the committee. My name is Kim Lowry. I'm a staff member of the Arthritis Foundation here in Oregon, and I work on behalf of the 782,000 people with arthritis, the adults, and the 3,400 children with doctor-diagnosed arthritis. The Arthritis Foundation, as well as my other patient groups, we oppose this bill. For Oregonians with arthritis and other rheumatic conditions, biological products are life-changing treatments. In many cases, they mean the difference between a lifetime of disability and a lifetime of full participation in work and civic life. But biologics are complex medications, and rheumatic conditions are complex as well. They require a high level of communication between all players on the healthcare team. Individual patients can experience different reactions between batches or preparations to the currently branded biological medications, and there's a great variation between patients. Biosimilars are follow-on products that are similar to the reference biological drug, and the Food and Drug Administration will likely make the determination that some of these medications are interchangeable biosimilars, meaning that they are therapeutically very similar but not the same as their reference products. So for patients who need those biologic medications to control their diseases but struggle to afford these therapies, biosimilars and interchangeable biosimilars offer hope for more affordable access to the treatment. However, because these medications and the diseases they treat are very complex. The interchangeable biosimilars are not the same as generic. The Arthritis Foundation urges the legislation to ensure that legislation adopted keeps patients' best interests. So we're here in plain language for the people we serve to ask you to consider legislation around biosimilars with the answer to the questions, why would my doctor not be informed when my medication is changed? Why wouldn't the pharmacy tell me when my medication is changed? We want to make sure that we have the best information at hand for all of our patients. And as a mother of a 20-year-old college student who I give 2 injections a week because of his arthritis, I want to know what my kid's getting. I want to know what I'm giving him. I don't want someone else to decide that. I want to have first knowledge and share that with our doctor to make sure that we're all on the same page. So we urge you, first and foremost, to take care of the best interests of our patients with the complex condition as you weigh the merit of House Bill 2026. And does it really answer the questions our patients are asking? So on behalf of the Arthritis Foundation and the 782,000 Oregonians with arthritis, I want to thank you for your time and consideration in the opposition of this bill.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Troy Rayburn. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, which is the advocacy arm of the American Cancer Society. I'm not going to read my full testimony to you. I know that each of
you
did your homework.
Thank you
very much. So I'm just going to highlight a couple points and let the previous folks' testimony fill the blanks. We urge your opposition to House Bill 2026 because it allows pharmacists in Oregon to substitute interchangeable biosimilars without communicating that information with prescribing physician. We would support if the bill was amended to require communication within 10 calendar days or 5 business days. Substituting a biosimilar without the prescribing physician's knowledge or a record that he or she may easily access is not sound medical policy and could potentially jeopardize the patient's safety. Once again, as a result, we urge your opposition to House Bill 2026.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions to this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
I close the public hearing on House Bill 2026. I'm going to announce we're going to carry over House Bill 2541 till Wednesday and open a public hearing on House Bill 2028. What do we have here?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2028 directs the State Board of Pharmacy to adopt rules that permit pharmacists to engage in the practice of clinical pharmacy. The bill defines clinical pharmacy agreement and the practice of clinical pharmacy.
And will you call the first panel?
I will.
We have 3 more hearings. We're doing fine, but we need to hold each of these for about 20 minutes to get done in time. So I'll ask you all to use as much time as you absolutely need, but not a second more.
Corey Hout, Josh Bishop.
Yay. You got another one?
Just two? These two are the kickoff.
Okay. Kick us off.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Josh Bishop. I'm the pharmacy director for Pacific Source Health Plans. I'm also a member of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and a past president of that association as well. I'm going to kick off this presentation. Corey Hewitt, who is the chair of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition and a vice president of pharmacy at Arden Health, will talk to you more about the specifics of the bill and how it enables pharmacists to provide more clinical pharmacy services, and we'll expand on what those are. I'm going to start just to ground us with one quotation, a brief quotation from the Institute of Medicine that says, "Pharmaceuticals are the most common medical intervention. Their potential for both help and harm is enormous. Ensuring that the American people get the most benefit from advances in pharmacology is a critical component of improving the national healthcare system." I think we're all pretty well aware of that, but as pharmacists, we are acutely aware of both the benefits and the harm of pharmaceuticals. In 2015, the National Governors Association did a study on 117 million people. They found that 50% of that population had at least one chronic condition. They found that per capita, the average patient was taking 12.6 medications. So those are undoubtedly valuable medications, improving the health and quality of life for those patients. But to emphasize the Institute of Medicine quote, there are separate studies that quantify the harm of inappropriately dosed or coordinated medications with other pharmaceuticals or non-adherence at $290 billion annually. That's 13% of the total healthcare expenditures, and it's not just an economic problem. This is a clinical problem. That same study estimated 1.1 million deaths annually due to inappropriate use of medications. It's not all doom and gloom. There are opportunities. Pharmaceuticals provide great advances and improve the quality of life for Americans. The Surgeon General Report in 2011 highlighted some of those opportunities. And this slide speaks to the economics of that opportunity. Pharmacists in evidence-based literature are providing services that are improving the outcomes of patients but also generating a positive return on investment. In this study, that was 10 to 1 at the highest, on average 5 to 1 return. So for every dollar spent, $5 saved through the provision of clinical pharmacy services. I'm going to go to the next slide really quick just to ground us a little bit more in what clinical pharmacy services are. This is not your traditional dispensing role that a pharmacist has at Walgreens, Rite Aid, or other big box retailers or independent pharmacies. This can be provided by those pharmacists as an augmentation to a dispensing practice. But this is a pharmacist working with the care team, physicians, nurses, care managers, social workers, to improve the outcomes of pharmaceuticals. This is working through the medications, looking for drug interactions that can be avoided, helping patients understand the importance of their medications so that they stay adherent, helping doctors discontinue medications that are no longer necessary. The real savings, the win that comes from clinical pharmacy services, are not in reduced drug costs. In many cases, we add drug costs to a regimen to improve outcomes. This is in avoiding ER utilization, avoiding inpatient utilization, improving the quality of life for the patient, and improving their awareness of their medication. The last slide that I have before I hand it over to Corey Hewitt is at Pacific Source, we've been trying to do this for about 5 years now. We're not... We're unique in this. Most health plans are not doing this. But for the last 5 years, we've been providing some degree of clinical pharmacy services, either in physician offices, in community pharmacies, in some cases telephonically, and in some cases in our offices at Pacific Source. Our experience over that 4 years has varied, but it's always been positive. 2-to-1 return on investment, up to an 8-to-1 return on investment, depending on the year, depending on the patients that we enrolled in those programs. We support the bill. We're very excited about House Bill 2028 and what it can do for patients. We want to make sure that any pharmacist who's credentialed in the state of Oregon can practice clinical pharmacy services. We also think it's important that this work is pursuant to a clinical pharmacy services agreement and not a mandate for payment, which the bill in its current form is not a mandate for payment.
Thank you.
One more.
Thanks, Josh. Again, for the record, my name is Corey Hewitt, Vice President of Business Development and Art and Health, and the current chair of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. This bill really outlines four main components. It kind of defines clinical pharmacy services.
Coalition is a combination.
So for the record, yes, Oregon Pharmacy Coalition is a conglomerate of the OSHP, which is the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists, and OSPA, the State Pharmacy Associations. So. This bill, we've been working on this for about 3 years. We know that pharmacists, we're trying to allow them to work atop their license. In the big integrated health systems, this is happening in pockets. And what this statute really does is allow us to scale this up. And so what happens, it defines the practice of clinical pharmacy services. And what it does, it's different from the traditional dispensing role. It allows that pharmacist to sit down with patients, do comprehensive medication reviews, and even do collaborative practice therapy with protocols in the conjunction with the team and the physician. It also allows us to kind of to define what the clinical pharmacy agreement is, and that's the second thing. So that agreement really expands on the current rule that we have with the Board of Pharmacy. So the Board of Pharmacy, it's very restrictive. It's kind of tied to one patient, one physician, and a prescription, and one pharmacist. And what we're trying to do with this is just really to scale that out, allow healthcare organizations such as CCOs, ACOs, payers, enter into these types of agreements based on what Josh just said about their experiences with their medicines to maximize the use of those medications and then help their outcomes. Then it also does one more thing. It expands on the statewide protocol. So the bill, the success that we've had with the vaccination legislation in the state of Oregon, helping with the public health, we are looking to expand those protocols into things such as smoking cessation and maybe travel medications. California recently passed some legislation last year that we thought that was beneficial. What that really does is allows the Oregon Health Authority to kind of come together with their physicians and their nurses and pharmacists to sit down and to develop a protocol based on the literature and where a patient could access our services anywhere. Without like a referral, kind of like a vaccine. That once that was vetted and approved through the Oregon Health Authority, the board would then administer rules around, you know, what the education requirements, what really is the protocol, what can and can't you do. And so we really think that's another beneficial for the public health. And then finally, it's got one more thing, and it allows for the payment of service. So you may or may not be aware that pharmacists are one of the only healthcare providers that are not recognized as providers. We do not are not recognized. What this does, redoes the insurance code to allow us to have payment. It's not a mandate for payment, like Josh said. If we want to enter into these agreements, such as a Pacific Source and a Legacy Health wanted to do some things, those negotiations and talks could happen, and then we could scale that up to meet our patients' needs. So.
Before I ask your questions, I'd like to do a shout out here to past Representative Jim Thompson, who is co-chair and vice chair of this committee. Worked this issue to get it to the point it is now, and he's if or when this passes, it'll be an honor of Jim.
Huge advocate, yep.
Is there any questions? Representative Kenny Geyer?
I was just going to echo that with Jim, same thing. I feel his presence here.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Next panel, please.
Jeremy Vandehay, Tom Holt, Courtney Dresser. The one that opposes has written testimony. So I don't know if she wants if she's even here.
Well, why don't you announce it?
I will when we get there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We're here generally in support of House Bill 2028. We pay today pharmacists for clinical services but usually in a clinical setting. So, for instance, in a warfarin clinic, the pharmacist uses a protocol for dosing, and that protocol is vetted by a committee within an institution or maybe from an individual physician. That's one example. There are a number of settings where we do this today, but we do think it is time to allow this to get expanded into the community pharmacy setting, where there are a lot of positive applications, particularly in managing chronic disease. We think it would be a very positive thing. We've thought for a long time that pharmacists are the least well-utilized professionals in the healthcare system relative to where their training and licensure is. In terms of the bill, we do have a couple of suggestions. We think it would be prudent to initially limit this to protocols written by a physician. And that would be mainly as a means to build confidence in the community and amongst other practitioners, and then look at perhaps nurse practitioners and PAs down the road. I think, as you know, a physician assistant works under an agreement with a physician. So if we have physician assistants doing a protocol, it's kind of a double delegation. And I think it would be just prudent to make sure these are working well out in the community setting before we expand to that point. And then lastly, in terms of recognition as providers, that issue is mainly around Medicaid and Medicare and being recognized as providers in those systems to be paid in either one of those.
I think the notion of being recognized as a provider is not the issue. It's recognized as a provider for payment purposes.
Exactly, as a provider for payment purposes. We as insurers don't need permission to pay any particular provider. We pay lots of different providers based on what the you know, evidence is of they're providing value in health care. And you know, we could make up some funny example of something that's not licensed, but if they were delivering a high value of in the system and we were confident the evidence was there, we could pay them. We don't need statutory permission. We think it would be appropriate to have some kind of a call out in this bill that's specifically directed at Medicaid and Medicare recognition for purposes of payment in this state. We don't feel we need the language around the insurance coverage of it. We've had some good conversations with the proponents, and I think we're all kind of noodling on how to accomplish that in the bill, and we'd love to be part of that.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehey with Kaiser Permanente. I'll be very, very brief. Just want to hit on one point that wasn't stated in the testimony earlier. As a fully integrated system, Kaiser serves about 500,000 members from Longview, Washington, down to Salem. Farther south, on our way down there. We've actually been able to provide several of these services in Washington. It's been allowed. We found it to be very effective, improve outcomes. And so we support this bill because it'll provide some alignment across our delivery system, allow us to provide these services under the same types of protocols with the same agreement with our medical group on both sides of the river. So I'll leave it there. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. We're still in a little bit of a neutrality state on this legislation. We see our members use this in a lot of closed systems, in some of the patient-centered primary care and medical home models, and it does work, and they are supportive of it. We're still a little iffy on how this would work in a community level and outside, and like a solo practitioner working with a Walgreens or a Safeway. So we're working with the proponents on it to figure out some of that language. And our providers do have some issues around Section 4, around the travel vaccines and the smoking cessation. And again, more importantly, about not necessarily offering those services, but the protocols around that. So those are the things we're still working on.
Well, I hope you continue to work with the providers and meet with the advocates, and let's get this perfected. Any questions of this panel? Mr. Kinnegar?
Well, just a comment. I was fortunate to be invited either by you or Representative Thompson to join this, and it's been great to see how far this bill has come and how you've built on the successes in California. And as I understand it, it's all of it is permissive, not mandatory, both in payment and to the extent that physicians or healthcare providers want to engage in a clinical pharmacy agreement. It's not mandated again. And so, you know, I think it's a fantastic concept. I think it's.
You help coordinate the.
Yes, I have been a part of it. Yeah. So happy to continue. I think it's 99% there. I'm eager to see it pass.
I guess I have to comment. Does somebody know I'm a pharmacist in recovery or something? But I had a paper published in 1962 proposing this model
wow.
for pharmacy. Well, it's about time we do it.
Persistence pays.
Yeah. Guys, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You want to acknowledge a written?
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you. It was on the sign-up sheet. Please, committee, be aware that there's a pharma statement submitted by Tara Ryan in opposition to the bill. And it's on the sign-up sheet that it's the written testimony.
Will you put it on OLIS?
It is on OLIS already. Can I say something about that?
Sure.
Sure. I did read that letter, and it talks about expanding scope, and I'm very clear if anyone is unclear about that, we should invite somebody up because it's not expanding the scope. This is already done. It's, as somebody said, one of the most underutilized pieces of our workforce after 4 years of postgraduate study in this. It's things that they are very well trained to do and already do, but it will streamline it in many ways. So it is not an expansion of scope of practice, which is one of the points of the letter.
Yes. And is Tara standing up?
I am.
Okay. Well, would you like
so maybe
to come?
You need to clarify it, maybe. Yeah.
I would say that we need
to. Please come forward.
Come forward.
That we're
wait a minute. You need to introduce yourself.
Say it again. Tara Ryan from Pharma.
Thank you. I would just say that we had concerns about scope, and that we have, I've been listening to this, and we had discussions, and that's why I chose not to come up and actually to comment on this. But we want pharmacists to be able to practice to the top of their license, and we're strong supporters of the medication therapy management and collaborative care models and things like that. We were interested in hearing sort of how this was going to play out, and we support continuing to go through this.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. So, having had more discussion since you submitted the letter, is there anything that you still feel is an expansion of scope of practice?
I think we have to have just a better understanding. I would look to the work that the Oregon Medical Association is doing to see how that plays out, and just continue to be involved and to watch this as it develops.
It'd be good to have you in favor of this one.
Yes.
So, if you say working with, that'd be great.
I'm not sure we're there yet, but it would be good to see how it plays out. Thank you.
See how it plays out. It'd be very nice to have pharma in favor of something. It would be a big CT.
We're working towards it.
Thank you very much. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2028 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2951. Madam Administrator, what do we got?
House Bill 2951 requires policies and certificate of health insurance that offer prescription drug coverage to meet the following cost-sharing requirements: that the combined cost of a copayment and co-insurance for a 30-day supply of a prescription drug may not exceed $100, that a prescription drugs are not subject to a deductible, that the cost of the copays and the co-insurance are applied to any deductible and other specified requirements. We have...
Please, everybody, keep it brief.
Thea Zajac, Sarah Truman, Jim Halls.
Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlich, members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2951. My name is Thea Zajac, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And I'm here working in coalition with a lot of other patient advocates in Oregon who have really come together to address the biggest barrier that the patients we serve face in accessing their health care, and that's the costs, the out-of-pocket costs imposed on them. For their medications and the treatment that they need. We know, I mean, we're living in a phenomenal time in terms of medical research and treatments. There are people with certain types of leukemia that can now take a pill every day that keeps their cancer in remission for the rest of their life. These are people that 10 years ago would have gotten this diagnosis and would have died within 6 months. But for some people, these treatments are out of reach because of the costs associated with them. And those are really as a result of the way that pharmacy benefits are designed within insurance plans. You're probably familiar, if you've ever filled a prescription, that there's tiers within a pharmacy benefit. So your generics are generally the most, the cheapest, and then it goes up. There's probably a brand tier, a preferred brand tier. So you'll have $10 for the generic, $20 for the brand, maybe a $40 non-preferred brand. And then what we're seeing now, and we're seeing this in all of the plans in the Oregon Health Care Exchange, is what's called the specialty tier. And all the drugs on that tier have what's called a co-insurance instead of a copay. So instead of a flat dollar amount, it's a percentage. And these percentages translate into $1,500, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 copays for the patients that we serve. And that's for a month prescription, a 30-day supply. So I think we can all agree that is a pretty astronomical amount of money for someone to pay for a drug that's going to keep them alive and healthy, taking care of their kids, going to work, paying taxes. We know from research that once a prescription goes above around $100, adherence drops off dramatically. And there's lots of other health impacts within the healthcare space that has. People, we know that patients we serve cut their pills in half, they skip medications, they take a pill every other day against their physician's advice. to make up for the cost that they have to pay for this. The Affordable Care Act did some things to help protect these patients, but by and large, most of the plans in the Oregon Healthcare Exchange have pretty high deductibles, and so these patients are hitting up against their deductibles and their out-of-pocket maxes in the first month or two of the year, maxing out credit cards, mortgaging their houses. You can imagine the things that people have to go through. So we're really proposing a simple solution to this, House Bill 2951, which would cap any prescription copay at $100, and that $100 copay would apply pre-deductible. It helps a patient spread out the cost of their medications throughout the year and make it much more feasible for them to afford the life-saving medications that they
need. What do you mean pre-deductible?
So instead of meeting your, if you have a $2,500 deductible, instead of paying your full deductible, which if you have a $2,500 coinsurance, you're paying that all in January. So instead of that, it applies pre-deductible, which is actually how a lot of the generic and lower tier copays already operate, that they're a pre-deductible copay. We did the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society commissioned some research from Milliman, which is an actuarial research firm, and they looked at a $100 cap, $150, a $200 cap, and how that would have an impact on real claims data based on rheumatoid arthritis patients, cancer patients, patients with HIV, to look at how it would impact their out-of-pocket costs over the course of a year, as well as whether or not it was feasible for insurance companies to really implement these prescription caps. And what we found is that it would have dramatic impacts, as you can imagine, on the out-of-pocket costs that patients pay over the course of a year, reducing what they have to pay by sometimes hundreds or, in some cases, $1,000 or $2,000 for the out-of-pocket costs over the course of the year. In addition, the $100 cap, if you look at in terms of how the healthcare exchange plans are designed, if you looked at silver plans and above and you put that $100 cap in place, it is feasible for an insurance company to keep their premiums premium neutral, which means Milliman defines that in their report as a premium not going up more than 0.5%. So we're talking about a couple dollars per member per month that a premium would increase to make it much more feasible for these patients to afford their medications. We did submit some amendments to you that we're looking at to put a $200 cap at the bronze level just because of the actuarial value requirements there to keep them in compliance. It would need to be a little higher at the bronze level. So it's a simple solution, pretty straightforward. It would be so protective for these patients that need these drugs to stay alive. So thank you so much for your time. We look forward to your support on House Bill 2951.
Thank you.
Chairman Greenlich and the committee, thank you so much for hearing my testimony. My name is Sarah Truman, and I live in Beaverton. I have had psoriasis since 1994 and psoriatic arthritis since 2006. They are both serious autoimmune diseases with profound physical, psychological, and economic burdens, and they both put me at risk for increased heart disease, stroke, and death, amongst other comorbidities as well. Treatment with specialty drugs like biologics can help reduce my risk for these comorbidities. Additionally, treating my psoriatic arthritis is vital to prevent irreversible joint damage for me. When I was first diagnosed, I had health insurance but no prescription coverage, and this is what interested me in becoming a patient advocate. I literally spent all of my money on medications just to be able to get out of bed and go to work. I could not walk. I was confined to bed. Eventually, as my psoriatic arthritis became worse, I couldn't even do that anymore. As a single mother of three boys, this was devastating for me. I had cycled through numerous medications and had little success. I had given up hope of being able to work or being able to walk. I was confined to the bed, the couch, and the chair. My grade school children, my parents, and my friends were taking care of me. My world had come to an end as I knew it, and I was getting ready to apply for disability. I was depressed and struggling with the why me syndrome. In 2009, my doctor introduced me to my first biologic. It tremendously improved my quality of living. I could walk with the limp, but I could still walk. We tried the next one. I made much more progress. I could still not live a full life, but it was, I could still get out of bed and make it to work. For me and others like me, you become immune to medications over time. So I get about 18 months to 24 months out of a biologic before I have to switch to another one. I'm currently on Remicade, which has completely changed my life. I receive this infusion every 4 weeks, and I would not be here with you today without it. For me and many others, this medication can be very difficult to access, and the financial burden is extreme. I believe you all have a copy of my latest EOB. This is one for 1 month, and I get this every 4 weeks. I am charged a co-insurance on this. It's very expensive, and this is just one medication for me. This is the rest of what I take in a month, and many of these are also specialty medications. I live a healthy life. This is a genetic disease I got. I don't drink. I don't smoke. If there's a diet, I've tried it. If there's a homeopathic remedy, I've tried it. If there's a lotion, a cream, if there's something, I have tried it. And so has everybody else out there just like me. I don't want to choose between paying rent, buying groceries, paying the light bill, and medications. I make a really good salary. I wait in line at the food bank all the time because I can't afford to pay those things. If I can't pay for my medications, then I can't work. If I can't work, then I can't support my family. I live with my sister right now because I can't afford to live on my own. I've went to college. I have multiple degrees. I've spent my time to make a better life for my family, and it's very hard to do. Capping the co-payments is very important to me. That's even if you cap it at $100, that's still, I can't even tell you how many pills I take or how many prescriptions I take. That's a lot for me. This House Bill 2951 makes a difference to me and so many others like me that I talk to so often. I don't like taking these medications, but I have no choice. I have tried so many medications before I moved on to biologics. They were a last resort for me. No one wants to live with a suppressed immune system. I don't want to give myself injections. I don't want to check into a hospital for 4 hours every 4 weeks to be hooked up to an IV, damaging my internal organs. My own price has been liver failure to trade off so I could walk, but it's been my trade-off. Although I'm not 100% of what I used to be, I'm a fully functional, working, tax-paying citizen of this great state. Thousands of Oregonians with chronic diseases like me rely on specialty medication to live a normal life. I believe House Bill 2951 is good for Oregon and will improve the health of thousands of Oregonians, including myself. I respectfully urge all members of the Health Committee to support this legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to share my story.
Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, and to those on both sides of the aisle.
Your name, please.
My name is James Halls, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak and share not only my story as a leukemia and lymphoma volunteer, but also as a multiple myeloma patient. As a person who feels he's somewhat savvy to politics and understand there are not always easy answers. There are two sides to any agenda. But also know at some point we as a people have to get to the point to do the right thing. And in this instance, out-of-pocket medical costs that can and is devastating to the patient and their family. I know firsthand of this after my own diagnosis in March of 2005. To share my story and give some perspective, I was a 44-year-old. A 44-year-old man working for a large healthcare organization in Portland. I had fantastic health insurance benefits. But what crystallized for me in March 21st, 2005 is when my world, from my perspective, crashed around me. By the end of that week, I had multiple x-rays, CTs, MRIs, two biopsies, and met with both a radiation oncologist for radiation treatment planning and met with an oncologist to get a handle on what was in front of me. With my medical background, I knew the situation. When I look at an x-ray, I know what I'm looking at. But when you ask the oncologist, how long do you have? And the answer is about 6 months, because the cancer tumors had spread to about 80% of my body. Think Lance Armstrong. I not only had treatment decisions and considerations to make, but moreover, I was a single dad with three teenagers still at home and one at college to consider. That said, the treatment decisions were easy, because if we were not aggressive, then I wouldn't have even had a chance to finish raising my kids. To my point, I remember on April 1st, 2005, I was filling my first prescription at the hospital where I worked since 1976. I grew up with many of the people there and knew the people behind the counter in the pharmacy. So when I picked up a handful of prescriptions, I was told my copay payment was, and as I recall, was almost $1,000. My response was, "April Fool's, right?" She said, "No, Jim, that is your out-of-pocket portion." I gulped as I reached for my debit card. What I can tell you about this particular disease, which is not exclusive just to me, it is chronic, incurable, and with each occurrence comes back more aggressive, and the treatments are very expensive. As for me, I found myself in some type of treatment 8 of the last 10 years with devastating financial consequences, to the point where you can answer the question, how much is my life worth? It is easy to answer, but to get to those first couple of years, I had to max out my two credit cards up to $20,000, take a second mortgage that's up to $70,000, and took my retirement monies with significant penalties to pay my out-of-pocket medical expenses. Was it worth it? I don't know, but hindsight's 20/20. So you can always look back and think, what could I have done financially a little differently? Well, you do what you have to do in the moment, but what I can say is, due to those out-of-pocket costs, is I lost my home to the bank, refinanced my credit card debt, sold any and all valuables to pay those medical creditors. So what does my life look like now? I'm now on Social Security disability, which I'm very grateful for. I live in a small 775-square-foot apartment in Beaverton. I drive a 2001 Chrysler Sebring. And just last week finished my 8th week of chemotherapy after a biopsy in December 29, 2014, demonstrated the cancer had come back aggressively and its 70% involvement in my bone marrow. I'm not here looking for anybody to feel sorry for me, but I'm here as an advocate for those who are not here to speak for themselves. And hopefully there can be legislative compromise to help others who have significant health challenges and associated costs now and in the future. I am grateful for what I have, and the reality for each and every one is in this room and outside this building, we're all going to have challenges. That is part of living. But what we can do is be smart, live through our hearts, and I said, as I preface this, do the right thing. And my belief is doing the right thing is try to minimize the costs for those people who have significant healthcare challenges that require ongoing treatment, to help them at least at some point stay afloat. Because we're not asking for any handouts. I, like you, have a couple degrees. I worked very hard, started mowing yards when I was 8 years old. But I would like to see some compromises where we can keep people from drowning. Thank you for your time and consideration, and I look forward to see how this all comes about. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank
guys.
You for sharing.
We have two panels in opposition. I'm going to like to ask them to be as brief as possible. Will you call the next panel?
Leanne Gassaway, Robert Judge, Josh Bishop.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Leanne Gassaway. I'm with America's Health Insurance Plans, which is the national trade association representing about 1,000 insurance companies, and we cover about 200 million Americans. Our plans cover about 3 million Oregonians here in the state. I want to talk today first about House Bill 2951. Most notably, pharmaceutical advances have changed the way that we're doing medicine. We have the ability to use life-saving medications that have revolutionized the treatment of certain diseases, and you've heard that today. cancer sucks. I can get a round of applause for that. Rheumatoid arthritis is awful. These are horrible diseases of which, in the past, we have been unable to treat effectively, and we are able to treat those today using advances in pharmaceutical research, and so we want to be able to continue that. Prescription drugs, as you heard earlier, used to not be an essential health benefit. It is now an essential health benefit in every health insurance policy in the state through the Affordable Care Act. So individuals, families, employer coverage, et cetera, all have pharmaceutical coverage as part of their essential health benefits today. It's part of the package. So those are two really important things to remember as we enter into this discussion. I offer my comments today in opposition to House Bill 2951 because it's limiting co-payments does nothing to address the high cost of pharmaceutical drugs. And that's really the issue that we would like to talk about. Instead, it's a proposal that allows pharmaceutical manufacturers to continue to have a blank check to charge whatever they want for the drugs that they are selling to the public. It's an unsustainable approach in the pricing of life-saving medications that threatens the viability of public health programs like the Oregon Health Plan, the employee benefits under OEB and PEB.
I ask you to speak to this bill? Because I don't believe this bill in any way affects whether pharmaceutical manufacturers will increase or decrease their prices. That's given. This is a bill about determines the extent to which the cost of those drugs is spread across an insurance population or is heavy loaded on the people who have to use it. So I ask you to...
Certainly. I'll focus in on that.
If
then.
This bill, not passing it, would reduce the cost of pharmaceuticals that cost $100,000, we'd all be for it. But you know it's not going to have any effect on that.
I would agree with that, Mr. Chairman. So let's talk about what's important here. This is basically a shell game. And so what it does is it takes the cost of high-priced pharmaceuticals.
I need to interrupt again. We have a tradition in this body where we don't impute other people's motives. Calling this bill a shell game impugns the people that brought it forward, and we just can't allow that to happen.
My apologies, Mr. Chairman. It gets to the cost-shifting argument that you've raised here, so that's why I'd like to address.
Shell game is a con game, and I assure you the people who brought this, as you heard, are serious in their proposal.
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Well, then I'd appreciate it if you'd be careful about how you...
And I mean no disrespect at all with that. I think what I'm trying to...
You may not have meant it, but it was disrespectful.
My apologies. What I'd like to point out is that what happens and the reports that have come out in the last several months, whether it's reports on pharmaceutical pricing, whether it's reports about how capping copays affects the actuarial value of various products, what it does show is that if we lower prescription drug copays in one section of the benefit plan, it has to be found somewhere else in the product.
Absolutely.
And so it's going to raise premiums for bronze, silver plans, potentially all the way up to platinum plans. And more importantly, it's potentially going to raise copays in other segments of the benefit product. So for example, a report that was mentioned earlier, the Milliman report that was just released, it showed that, in fact, it does raise premiums potentially up to 5% in the bronze plan if the copay cap is lowered. And more importantly, to remain actuarially valued where it needs to be according to the ACA, which is at that 60% level, it needs to raise primary care visits potentially up to $85 per primary care visit to continue to allow that product to remain compliant with the ACA requirements. We think that is an honest discussion that needs to occur about the trade-offs we're making to allow high-priced pharmaceuticals to be hidden from the public, because if a patient pays $100, they'll never know that drug costs $100,000. And we won't have this public discussion that we need to have about the high cost of prescription drugs. And so it will simply be pushed somewhere else into the benefit plan, where that's in primary care visits, higher deductibles, higher out-of-pocket maxes for the other patients who are going to have hospital visits, lab visits, physician visits, and the like, will be paying more so that we can continue to put pharmaceutical drugs in a different category. So that was what I was trying to get at that, and hopefully I've clarified that for the committee. What we believe we should be talking about is choices. To allow product differentiation and choices, many of the gold and platinum products allow cost savings and lower co-insurance and lower co-payments amount to be put into the benefit design for those specialty drug tiers. So those products are available here in the state of Oregon. And we think those ought to be continued to be allowed to be in the state of Oregon. We also want other affordable options to be able to be allowed and available to purchasers in the state as well, particularly in the bronze, which is about 22% of purchasers today in the exchange or bronze. Bronze plan purchasers, those would be affected most notably by this. And so we just want to be cognizant that there's choices available to meet the financial and health needs of anybody who's purchasing health insurance, whether that's an employer, whether that's the state, whether that's an individual through the exchange. There's also cost-sharing reductions for those that are buying through the exchange that directly go to this point to help those afford lower cost sharing, whether it be lower out-of-pocket maxes, lower deductibles, and lower copays. We think that is something we ought to be talking about and looking at instead of just simply capping copays and allowing that to be kind of the sledgehammer approach to this issue. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Judge. I'm the Director of Pharmacy Services for Moda Health, which is a regional health plan serving members in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska for dental, medical, and pharmacy. The testimony we heard this afternoon is difficult to listen to, and my heart goes out to the testimony we heard and the witnesses' challenges to deal with these really terrible diseases that they have. But as my colleague pointed out here, it does nothing to really address the real issue, which is the cost of drugs. But I'm not going to spend my time talking to that. MoDA is opposed to House Bill 2951, which purports to help consumers with high drug costs, as it would not lower drug costs for anyone. Instead, it would shift the cost of pharmacy benefits, providing pharmacy benefits for individuals, and will remove key tools that we use as insurers to help steer patients to more cost-effective, therapeutically effective alternatives. The legislation is not in the interest of consumers, employers, the state, and will lead to increased drug costs for all. There are three reasons why we're opposed to this. First, House Bill 2951 will tie the hands of payers to control escalating drug crisis. Today, most health plans use different co-payments, as was testified earlier by other witnesses, tiered co-pays and out-of-pocket maximums to keep drug prices or costs for consumers as low as possible. These tools typically are based on whether a drug is generic, preferred, non-preferred, or specialty. And they seek to steer patients to the lowest cost therapeutically effective medication. House Bill 2951 will remove the ability of payers to use co-payments to help steer utilization and will do nothing to lower the cost of the drugs that are ultimately paid for. Second reason, House Bill 2951 gives manufacturers a free ride. The use of drug tiering combined with co-payments helps payers manage drug costs. By capping co-payments and removing preferred cost tiers, House Bill 2951 will allow manufacturers to set prices in the market and remove the ability for payers to use these strategies to offset their prices. It will also allow manufacturers to back out of a really important tool for individuals who struggle to meet the cost of drugs called copay assistance programs that they fund for those individuals who require financial assistance on the cost of medications, because they will essentially shift that burden to payers. House Bill 2951 will result in shifting costs to taxpayers, employers, and insurers in the form of higher drug costs. Finally, House Bill 2951 is not in the interest of consumers. While couched as legislation supporting consumers, and we all want that, in fact, the legislation will give pharmaceuticals manufacturers a free rein to get their products prescribed and paid for by payers and taxpayers without competing on price in the marketplace. This legislation will remove
I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up.
Last sentence.
But go ahead with your last sentence, and then I have a question for you.
Yeah. It will remove the ability for payers to place preferences on products that are equally efficacious but less expensive for members. And for this reason, we're opposed to 2951.
If you have an estimate of, for MOTA, what this bill would increase your average premiums by?
Yeah, so we've done it a couple ways. We have, we cover the OEB employee population, and it will increase their costs, a couple million dollars.
What percent?
So a little over 0.5%, 6%, about 0.6%. But for our commercial clients, it'll raise it about a point.
About 1%.
Yes.
So the impact of doing this would raise the premiums between 0.5% and 1%.
Of this particular bill, yeah.
Thank you. Yes, please wrap up.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'll be brief. Pacific Source Health Plans represents about 250,000 members across three states, Oregon, Idaho, Montana. Mm-hmm. We participate in Medicare, commercial, and Medicaid, including two CCOs in Oregon. We're very concerned, we're very empathetic to the concerns raised here about the rising cost of pharmaceuticals and the impact that that's having on patients. There's no question that it's unfair. And we support the use of these medications. They're innovative advancements in healthcare. They're improving quality of life. However, we believe that pricing being set by pharmaceutical manufacturers is irresponsible and is placing an unjust burden on both patients and the healthcare system. In preparing for this testimony, I did some data analysis on our own claims experience. Traditionally, non-specialty pharmaceuticals cost total drug costs $200 to $300 per prescription. The member cost share, based on our experience, is between 15 and 20% of that. That's what we're used to. That's what most of our experience has been on. The new advent of innovative specialty medications, as you heard today and as you're probably well aware, it's not unusual for a prescription to cost $100,000 for a single patient, even for as little as a 12-week course of medication. It's very common for those medications to be in the order of $3,000 to $5,000. There are a lot of medications in that space. Based on our utilization, the member cost share of the specialty medications is approximately 5%. In contrast to the 15 to 20% that we see in member cost share for non-specialty medications. The rebuttal point might be very valid that 5% of $3,000, $5,000, $100,000 is still a lot of money, and that's unfair to consumers and patients, and we acknowledge that. Unfortunately, these medications are increasing in our budget. While the specialty medications are currently representing about 30% of our overall budget. That's increasing. According to some of our studies, 38% increase in pricing amongst the specialty pharmaceuticals. And those only represent 0.5% of the total prescription volume that we pay for. I'll conclude with this. We are a strong proponent of maintaining manageable out-of-pocket costs for our members to ensure their own financial independence. It's unfortunate that the financial responsibility of patients is increasing due to the rising prices of pharmaceutical manufacturers. However, it is important to appreciate that the higher proportion of these specialty pharmaceutical costs are being shifted to health plans and employers. The vast majority of those costs are coming to health plans and employers, not to consumers. And consumers are protected by mandated out-of-pocket costs, whereas health plans and employer groups are not. The premium trajectory that is created by irresponsible pricing and legislative mandates is unsustainable. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Two questions, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to ask one more person to come up while you're asking those questions.
Okay.
I have a Mr. Tilley who's coming from 100 miles away. Is that right? Yeah. So I'd like to get your testimony on this bill, too. If you could. Go ahead with your questions.
My first question is, does the insurance plan negotiate with the drug company in terms of what they pay? Anyone of you can answer.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, drug prices are paid for by pharmacies. Pharmacies usually purchase their drugs from wholesalers who negotiate with drug manufacturers for the prices.
Okay.
Do you have a pharmacy benefit manager?
Yeah. So
does that negotiate in answer to his question?
We negotiate what we pay pharmacies for those drugs.
Okay. All right, thank you. That was
helpful.
We don't
buy the drugs.
Okay, but they're all right. I'm just learning about pharmacy. All right, then, just Doesn't medication help with hospital costs? I'm sure I heard some advocate explain to me that hospital costs used to be the biggest expense in the market, but now pharmaceuticals are outpacing them. And in some ways, don't they help get the cost of another part of this down if we make prescriptions more affordable? People don't have hospital stays then?
As an insurer, we see across medical and pharmacy and dental, we see pharmacy drug costs. Members of the committee.
No.
We see our costs approaching 20-25% of total medical expenses. That's driven through a couple of things. One is these new biological remedies that are coming out to treat really hard to treat conditions that have not been treated before. So in that respect, we're prolonging lives and we're helping the people suffering from these conditions have better lives.
The a lot cheaper when they died early.
But the other side of this is that there is, as Josh referenced, there are drugs that are in the marketplace. Manufacturers have already got these products in the marketplace, and they increase, on average, 20-25% a year. The drug prices are increasing for drugs that are already in the marketplace. By removing tools from payers to negotiate how they reimburse for drugs limits our ability to put any cap at all in terms of what prices are charged for in the marketplace.
Chair Greenlink, Representative Nose, members of the committee.
I'm going to ask Mr. Tilley to give his testimony, please.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carlton Tilley, members of the committee. How are you doing today? What I'm seeing in the House bill here is the health care laws has been actually really rough this year coming in on a lot of small businesses, and I am a small business owner here in the state. And I'm looking at another government mandate coming down from the state that may make me pretty uncompetitive to be able to bring talent from local or even outside of the state and to work for me. As costs go up, and you set a cap on this, the way I understand it is this is also going to affect the way that I offer insurance to my employees. Now, the big guys, they can afford to absorb the cost. You know, unfortunately, a little bit smaller guys like me, I can't. You know, we're already in a bad economy and things are stressed pretty tight. And it's rough. So, you know, bringing in another possible government mandate and having to set this stuff down on me, it actually is putting, you know, a lot of employees, you know, possibly on layoff. Or we're not even going to hire employees anymore, you know. As like many other employers in the state, even small guys, you know, we're actually starting to look at having to go outside of the state because of some of the laws and stuff coming in. Folks, you know, I just don't know anymore. But the cost I'm going to have to pass along in the way that it looks like the cap is going to raise prices, you know. And that's not good.
Mr. Tilley, we hear you and we worry about that. And we hope that the small business piece of the exchange is going to find a way to get you more affordable and effective health insurance. And we know small businesses are really stressed over this. And we definitely understand that.
Yes, sir.
We appreciate you coming to talk to us about it. We will have that on our mind.
Thank you, committee members. Appreciate your time.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just Just a comment, I guess. I guess I'm having a hard time buying the argument that these high copayments make the case for controlling costs and reducing costs. You know, I guess the reason is, as the advocates were telling me about one patient who had an enormously high copayment on some medication for cancer, and his solution was to cut the pill in half and go twice as far. And it kind of broke my heart.
It will reduce the cost of drugs, the extent to which people can't afford to pay the copay and won't get their prescription filled.
Exactly. I mean, this is a terrible dilemma on both ends of it.
but we'll be back to this one. I need to close this hearing because we...
Mr. Chair, if I could real quick, just a quick comment.
All right, just a minute. Let me call somebody up on the next thing and you can hear. I'm going to open up a public hearing on the last bill we have. We're going to try and find folks who have come from 100 miles to come and give testimony. We have about 12 minutes to do that. I'll ask the two people who didn't get to testify, the frequent flyers, they could, I appreciate if they'd send their comments by mail, I mean electronically to us. And if you would call the first panel of folks, we'll let Representative Widener.
And we're talking about House Bill 3486.
I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3486.
Leanne Gassenwall and Josh Bishop.
Did I close? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2951. Yes, Representative Widener, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think with a lot of these bills that are coming forward, I think some of the stuff we need to look at is how we approach going after some of these issues, because right now we're looking at co-pays, and I wonder if we should be looking at insurance companies, the state. We're going to pay this much for that drug. We'll pay $200 for this drug. Anything above that would be out of a person's pocket or whatever, because now as a manufacturer, I start designing and putting things to my cost. It's just like when I design or develop any piece of equipment, I know what the market will bear, and if it's this much, I'm building it to that price. I know where my competitors are, and I think we could get a huge advantage on the generic prescription drugs if we started doing that, because they're going to come down because they know people aren't going to pay out of their pocket, and they're going to do it for that price point. So just something to throw out there to think about, but I think we're...
You really do need to think about how to deal with this.
Because we're going this way rather than this way with a lot of the stuff that we
you
do.
You can figure out a way to get Pharma to reduce their prices. We're going to be right there with you on that. That's serious. Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Leanne Gassaway. I'm with America's Health Insurance Plans, and I testify today in strong support of House Bill 3486. 3486 brings the information that we desperately need. Today, policymakers and the public have no data on how prescription drugs are priced. We hear from pharmaceutical industries that they are setting their prices to recoup research and development costs and to invest in new therapies. However, it is estimated that pharmaceutical companies spend less than 20% of their revenue on research and development of new medications. I have provided the committee with a graphic courtesy of Vox that shows the percentage of revenue spent on both research and development and sales and marketing of prescription drugs for the 10 largest manufacturers. This picture clearly shows that it's not R&D that is driving high prices, that R&D funding is actually dwarfed by the funds allocated towards sales and marketing of those drugs. This information that Vox put together required extensive review of hundreds of SEC filings to determine overall spending by these drug makers, yet this information is not readily accessible to policymakers or the public, and we think it's time to change that. Over the last several decades, the use of prescription drugs has been increasing significantly, and it now accounts for approximately 14% of total claims paid by health insurers. That's up from 10% just a few years ago. That is third behind hospitals, which are number one, and physicians, which are number two. In Oregon, we require hospitals to report in their cost data so that policymakers can see how that is working and in the state and get an idea of how to go about policy solutions dealing in the hospital arena. We think that there is no such data available for prescription drugs, which are rising faster than any other sector of the healthcare system. You also have a graphic that shows that they are rising at twice the rate of any other sector of the healthcare system. The bill, House Bill 3486, requires that certain information about drug pricing be submitted for drugs that cost more than $10,000 per month. This streamlines the focus on high-cost drugs that we've been discussing today and avoids the unnecessary administrative burden on many drug makers that produce lower-cost drugs. More importantly, the bill asks for information that is not proprietary or confidential in nature. It asks for aggregate costs that the manufacturer has tracked in the development, production, and distribution of that drug. Since many of these medications are actually supported by taxpayer-funded clinical research, we think it's imperative that the public notice and understand how those funds are being spent. This bill does not require proprietary payment rates that drug makers may pay clinical trial practitioners or any kind of detailed trade secrets. It simply asks for information that is part of the overall drug development process, none of which would produce competitive harm to the drug maker. As to the use and cost of prescription drugs continues to rise, it's critically important that we understand the investment that we're making in the development and marketing of such drugs in order for policymakers to ensure continued access to those affordable medications and to support innovation for new therapies. This legislation requires certain drug makers to report development, production, and distribution and administrative costs for the prescription drugs they're offering to patients in Oregon. It seeks to allow consumers and policymakers to have essential information about the underlying costs of prescription drugs and develop a solution to enable continued access to those affordable medications. We thank you for considering our comments today and ask for your support in this endeavor as we work together to develop solutions that will ensure affordable, accessible, high value, and choice of medications. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'll be brief. I have a brief testimony this morning. My name is Josh Bishop, Pharmacy Director for Pacific Source. Pacific Source supports House Bill 3486, and we believe that public transparency to healthcare financing is a significant step toward a more sustainable healthcare system for the state of Oregon. Health plans have been held to public filing requirements for many years, and we believe it is reasonable that pharmaceutical manufacturers be held to similar standards. This bill does nothing to impose pricing sanctions on the high cost of pharmaceuticals, and it will not, because of that, impact the availability of innovative new medicines to Oregonians. I'm going to read a brief excerpt from the World Health Organization that I think is very relevant. The global pharmaceutical market is worth $300 billion a year. It's expected to rise to $400 billion within the next 3 years. The 10 largest drug companies control over a third of this market, with many having sales over $10 billion annually. And their profit margins are about 30%.
What percent?
30%. Companies currently spend one-third of all sales revenue on marketing their products. That's roughly twice what they spend on research and development. That comes from the World Health Organization. We believe that providing transparency to this industry is a fair and reasonable request, given the great financial toll that pharmaceuticals are having on healthcare financing. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
I'm curious why you think that divulging the total profit margin on a prescription drug is not important proprietary information that companies would not want to have public.
Chairman and Representative Bueller, they report that to the SEC today as all publicly held pharmaceutical manufacturers today, so those profit margins are reported publicly.
And if they're not publicly traded?
We would see no reason why that information wouldn't be prudent to the public discussion to have around how those funds are being set and pricing of that product.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask one more representative who's come from a distance. Would you call?
Yeah. Tara Ryan.
And is there anybody? My intention is to carry over this hearing and open it Wednesday morning, but if there's anybody else for whom coming Wednesday would be a problem, please join us here. Thank you. Go for it.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you very much for taking the time to hear farmers' concerns with this legislation. Some of them have already been raised. Our primary concern is what this bill is asking.
Your name again, please.
Tara Ryan with Pharma.
Yeah.
Sorry. Our primary concern is if the bill is enacted, the data disclosed is not going to shed light on drug prices in a way that the public will be able to benefit from this information. It's not going to help them build strategies to help find a way to access needed medications. If the concern is to help ensure patients, this bill is not going to help ensure access. This bill is not going to do that. Earlier you mentioned, are there things that pharma can support? There are things that pharma can support, and a lot of it is related to transparency, and we're working in that arena across all of the states right now in helping patients have transparency so that when they're buying plans on the exchanges, they understand what it is that they're buying. They know who their providers are before they buy. They know who their hospitals are before they buy. They know what drugs are covered before they buy. They know if all of the drugs to treat the disease that they have, whether it's cancer or HIV or hepatitis C. If all of those drugs are on the highest cost-sharing tiers, they know that. That way they can get a sense of what their cost-sharing is going to be, and they can make decisions based on that. Those are the types of transparency that we're looking for. And And it's a little bit different than what this bill is asking. This bill, Pharma has a couple concerns with specifically. It's the proprietary information that Representative Buehler raised. Most of the information and the reason that the SEC filings that pharmaceutical companies use, it's aggregated data. It's not by drug. So it's out there, it's available, and if patients can make sense of it, then they have access to it. It's public filings. But doing it by drug-specific data is not, because it lends itself then to disclosure of proprietary information. Just to be clear, it would be nearly impossible for a company to break certain of this data down per drug, particularly costs associated with manufacturing. Companies operate multiple lines at multiple sites. They produce other products at the same sites, and they likely contract out of a lot of manufacturing. It's very difficult to do a per-drug breakdown of the data. Focusing on one drug and cost as a driver for transaction misunderstands incentives that drive investments and buyouts. Very few biopharm acquisitions include the calculus of just one drug potential. Further, even in those transactions, there are so many other factors at play. There's price risk. What if the drug ultimately fails? There are antitrust concerns. What if the regulators don't actually approve the deal? The idea that a single purchase price simply factors in the price that can be charged for a potential new drug candidate, it doesn't make sense. You can't glean that sort of information from transaction numbers, nor should anyone be looking at the purchase price and then comporting it to the ultimate price of the drug introduced. And that's the type of data that this bill is trying to collect. It doesn't really make sense in the way that these transactions
happen. You wouldn't say with a straight face that a pharmaceutical manufacturer doesn't know what the cost of producing each of their drugs would be.
I'm going to say, without disclosing proprietary information, I think the companies probably have a sense of what it costs. I think that disclosing that puts them at a huge disadvantage in the marketplace.
I understand that.
And that's what we're trying to protect.
But that's a different question.
Yeah.
Over that, it's hard to figure out how much it actually costs.
I think that in the way that the data is being asked to be disclosed here, it would violate a lot of proprietary rules, and it would be very hard to calculate.
I hear that.
It takes a lot just to do the SEC filings that the companies do, to do the aggregated data. So asking them to perform this administrative burden for the state of Oregon to disclose this type of information on a on a drug-by-drug basis.
Can I ask you to wrap it up? And if you're not available Wednesday, there's a guy in the back who sometimes represents pharma that could finish this discussion.
And he's got all the information, but I'm going to talk quickly. Can you give me one more minute?
One more minute.
All right. Going back to another comment that somebody made, transactions, the information that you hear about is transactions with public companies, and the financial information is generally public. But companies developing biopharmaceuticals are generally not public companies. They're really small biopharm companies, and they're to force private equity firms and other financial institutions that do the deals to buy these biotech companies and to take them private and to disclose that information about their transaction will result in fewer deals, particularly in places like Oregon, where these types of bills are here. They're going to be very unlikely to want to do that. And this is going to have a huge impact on incentives and the goals that that these biopharmaceutical companies are doing to try to bring these really inventive, innovative drugs to market. You're hearing from people who have rheumatoid arthritis, and you're hearing from people with cancer, and you're hearing, HIV, AIDS, all of these different diseases. The drugs have changed over time and over time and over time. You course out on a type of treatment, and you need new ones. So these biologics have to continue to be innovative, And to not be able to continue to invest in that, you're not going to see these changes in people who have rheumatoid arthritis or cancer. They're not going to get to the next phase because there's not going to be a new drug to treat their disease.
Sorry, I really need to ask you to stop.
Okay.
We have to be out of this room 3 minutes ago.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you. I'll be very, very brief. I'm not here to argue. My name is Ryan Dunlap. I'm the CFO of Galena Biopharma. We are a publicly traded company in Oregon, one of the few. We do mainly development of cancer immunotherapies, but we also have two specialty pharmacy drugs for cancer palliative care that we're currently commercializing. I'm not here to argue against transparency, nor am I here to refute any of the points made by the previous testimonials. But I do have based on my quick read, I do have a couple of things I want to point out as a former accountant, auditor, and CFO of this company that I see as very problematic and would cause this bill to be very difficult to implement. The first is consistency. You can be as transparent as you want, but one of the fundamental concepts of financial information is consistency, and I don't see how this bill achieves consistency among manufacturers. There could be a number of different ways that a drug gets brought to commercialization by the current manufacturer. It could have been brought all the way from the lab through the rigors of clinical trials, through FDA approval, and then to marketing and commercialization. It could have been purchased through a business combination or an asset acquisition. Now, various other means, partnerships and collaborations. Each of these have very different cost profiles. I'll give you an example. Our drug for breakthrough cancer pain and palliative care is called Abstral. We purchased Abstral from a company called Orexo. It was effectively an asset and licensing arrangement. We didn't put it through all the clinical trial process. That drug would qualify as us needing to report under this bill. It's about a $10 million a year product for us. We're not a large pharma company. Our competitors, who we priced our drug very similar to our competitors for competitive reasons. It's unclear whether our competitors would have similar cost profiles to report when reporting this information. That lack of consistency, in my view, renders this information meaningless, regardless of the transparency it provides. I also see that this lacks a framework of accounting. I will argue that the current SEC guidance, I can tell you as a CFO, does not require us to report this disaggregated information. There are a multitude of allocations and other accounting rigors that you would have to go through, and I don't see a framework applied to this. To me, that also adds to the inconsistency, and it's ripe for inconsistent application and practice, which also renders it inconsistent. I see a one-year look back. It requires data for the previous fiscal year. Again, that may or may not capture the costs that went into bringing this product to commercialization. It could have been a 10-year or longer runway between when the drug left the lab and to when it became commercialized. So it's not clear to me how this bill creates a consistent framework in reporting those costs, particularly with the one-year look back. And lastly, I will argue that a company like ours doesn't have the resources to comply. I think this would require a great deal of additional resource from a financial reporting standpoint. We already have to deal with SEC guidelines, PCOB guidelines, FDA guidelines. We're reporting in a number of different ways. We always strive for transparency, but those guidelines are built to ensure consistency to make that information meaningful, and I don't see that in this bill. I can tell you that what Galena would do in reaction to this bill is that we would just quit selling our drug in Oregon. And unfortunately, that's a downfall for the patients and not necessarily for the company. And I would fear that many companies might choose that route, given the fact that Oregon is really not a large marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing. Oh, I'm going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 3486. We'll open that as the first item of business on Wednesday. So those of you who want to get in at that point, please sign up again. And I'm sorry, but we have another committee coming in. We will have more time on Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, they don't give. The thing we do, raises. Don't report profit.
Close the thing we do, raises.
Don't report profit.
Close the point.
Yeah, I mean, they don't.